Good evening and welcome to Wednesday Night Bible Study. This is our last session of the summer, and I'm excited to wrap this thing up, not because I don't want to do this anymore, but because it's time to finish Micah, and it's time to start a new series. If you're tuning in tonight and you don't know who I am, my name is Sean Scribner. I'm the lead pastor here at Evangelical Methodist Church, and I've been teaching from the book of Micah all throughout the summer since really the beginning of June. But tonight is our last night, and it has taken, 3.5 months to get through 7 chapters of the Bible, which is actually a pretty fast pace for me. It took me, 3 or 4 times that long to get through Ephesians, which has even fewer chapters. So I don't know. We've kind of blitzed our way through, but it's time to wrap this up, and I'm looking forward to this time together tonight. Like I said, we are in Micah. And next week, Richard Maservi is going to be teaching, beginning a new series from 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. And I'm really excited for you to be able to participate in that, not only online, but in person. So Richard's going to be back in the fellowship hall, and you are invited to come out. Actually, next week we have a family night supper. So we're going to kick off the fall season with family night supper at 5:45. And then at 6:30, the kids and the teens will go to youth group and kids zone, and the choir will go practice in the choir room. And then at 7 p.m. in the fellowship hall, Richard Maservi will be teaching, and we are going to be streaming it right here on Facebook Live as well. So if you can't come for some reason, tune in here with us. I actually have John Parker in the studio here tonight, and he's checking out how all the everything works, and he's going to give us some help and making sure that we continue to stream Bible study on Wednesday night. So next time you see John, make sure you tell him thank you. And we're going to recruit some other folks to give us some help as well, because we want to keep bringing the ministry of the word to you, wherever you are. If you can't be here in person, we still want you to be able to participate. So that is our commitment to try to do that, and we're looking forward to making that all work. But tonight, we are finishing up Micah. We've been working all the way through since June 2nd was when we did our introduction there. We took some weeks off for various reasons, but we're finishing up here tonight in chapter 7, verses 8 through 20. As usual, I'm going to teach for a little bit, and at the conclusion of the teaching time, we'll cut away for just a short break and allow me a chance to catch my breath and look through the comment section for any prayer requests you put there. And then we're going to come back at the end and pray together. So when that transition time comes, don't turn off your screen or log out. Just stay put, and we'll come back after about 90 seconds or so and close our time with the time of prayer. We're aiming to be done right around 8 o'clock. So we've been doing pretty good with the time, and we're going to try to stick with that again this evening. So go ahead and start putting your prayer requests in the comment section now if you are able, and they will be ready for me when the time comes to pray. So that's at the end, but here at the beginning, let's open up with a word of prayer if we could. Father, thank you for this night. Thank you for just being with us through these months as we've taken our time to go through what for many of us seems like a very obscure book of the Bible. It's kind of hidden in the middle of all these minor prophets who are from a totally different time from us and a totally different place from us and are speaking to a unique situation that we have a hard time connecting with. And yet, because your word is true and because your spirit superintends the reading and the study and the proclamation of your word, we find it is alive and relevant even to us today. And we've learned lessons through this study, lessons about what you were teaching your people in Micah's day, but those same lessons you're teaching to us here today. And we want to be your people who are faithful to you and witness to your goodness before all the world. So, Lord, I pray that this evening would be fruitful as we wind this study down. Guide us and give us wisdom. Open our minds and hearts to the truth of your word. And through it all, we pray you would be glorified in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, let's take a moment and review, as is our custom. Last week, of course, we looked into rediscovering the lost art of lament. And of course, lament, biblically speaking, is not a hopeless despair, but rather a desperate cry directed to God. It's the heart's cry when we're in this troubled, broken world. And God invites us. In fact, we talked about the scriptures are full of laments. Some 40% of the Psalms are Psalms of lament. It's the cry, the spirit-led cry of the psalmist to God for the things that are just not right in the world. It's entering into to God's own feelings towards this broken world. And so Micah has been showing us when and how to lament rightly. And so when we did our study last week, we saw there were three things that he was lamenting. He was lamenting the absence of the righteous. So God created his people to be a priestly people, a holy kingdom of priests. And they were failing to do that. They weren't living up to his standards. They weren't imaging and modeling and proclaiming him to the nations like they were supposed to. And so Micah lamented the fact that there was an absence of the righteous among God's people. And you and I in the Christian church should lament the absence of God's righteousness among his people. Nothing in the world brings more reproach to the name of Jesus than when Christians don't live rightly. And so we want to be a people that lament it in the churches abroad, but also in our own hearts. If there's unrighteousness in my heart, that is something that is lamentable. And we need to direct that to God. Secondly, Micah laments the corruption of leaders, the people who have been charged to be stewards of power that God has granted for the ordering of human civilization and the right living as people in the world. When there's corruption from the top, it's something that should be lamented. And you and I live in a day and age when there is ample corruption among the highest levels of leadership, not only in our country, but in other countries and on the global scale. And that's something to lament and to direct our pleas to God. And you and I should be actively engaged in praying for our leaders and standing up for what is right and electing leaders who will stand up for what is right. So Micah gives us the model for that. He also laments the disintegration of civil society. So people who are, I think you remember, he was talking about setting up traps to ensnare one another. Rather than being a society where people are looking out for one another and caring for one another, a society defined by mutual love and provision for one for another, it's a society where people were taking advantage of each other. And all of these things that Michael laments are things that you could say describe our own culture, our own society. It's true. We live in a day and age when our own nation is not one that is how God designed it to be, a place of holiness and shalom. And so those are the right things to lament about. And not only does Micah show us the right things to lament about, he shows us how to lament. And he does so by doing it with hope. He doesn't lament out of despair. The world is ending. There's nothing anyone can do about it. So I'm just going to feel sorry for myself and, bury myself in a hole in the ground. That's not lament, biblically speaking. Micah looks to God. He looks to God. He waits for God. He puts his trust in God. Yes, his heart is broken. Yes, he's mourning. He identifies with the sins of his people. He's aware that God's wrath and judgment and discipline are appropriate for the situation, but he doesn't do it in a hopeless way. He trusts in the goodness of God. He trusts in the character of God. And we're going to see that theme again repeated tonight as we wind down the letter here. As Christians, of course, you and I know that the right place to take our lament is to the cross. It's there where God himself not only issued judgment upon the sins of the world, but he entered himself into the sins of the world. Jesus was without sin, and yet he became sin, our sin, suffering on behalf of us for the world that he wants to redeem. And as a result of the things that Jesus did for us on the cross and the grave and being resurrected and ascended into heaven, you and I are invited to lament in a biblical way with what has been called a confident sadness, one that moves us to look and to wait upon and to trust in Jesus. So that's a quick review of the last week or so. We're going to turn now to verse 8 in Micah chapter 7, and we're going to read down to the end of the book. So it's about 13 verses here. So follow along on the screen there if you would. Micah chapter 7, verse 8. Do not rejoice over me, enemy of mine. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I live in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. I will endure the rage of the Lord because I have sinned against him until he pleads my case and executes justice for me. He will bring me out to the light and I will look at his righteousness. Then my enemy will see and shame will cover her, who said to me, 'Where is the Lord your God?' My eyes will look at her, and at that time she will be trampled down like mud of the streets. It will be a day for building your walls. On that day, your boundary will be extended. It will be a day when they will come to you from Assyria and the cities of Egypt, from Egypt even to the Euphrates River, even from sea to sea and mountain to mountain. And the earth will become a wasteland because of her inhabitants, on account of the fruit of their deeds. Shepherd your people with your scepter, the flock of your possession, which lives by itself in the woodland, in the midst of a fruitful field. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead, as in the days of old. As in the days when you went out from the land of Egypt, I will show you miracles. Nations will see and be ashamed of all their might. They will put their hand on their mouth. Their ears will be deaf. They will lick up dust like a snake, like reptiles of the earth. They will come trembling out of their fortresses. To the Lord our God they will come in trepidation, and they will be afraid of you. Who is a God like you, who pardons wrongdoing and passes over a rebellious act of the remnant of his possession? He does not retain his anger forever, because he delights in mercy. He will again take pity on us. He will trample on our wrongdoings. Yes, you will cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob and favor to Abraham, which you swore to our forefathers from the days of old." Now, it's possible that at this point in the book, if you've been following along with us throughout the summer, when you come to these final verses in this last chapter, and you come upon yet another statement about God's judgment and wrath, you might be tempted to say, "Okay, we get it. We get it, God. You're unhappy with what we've done. We understand what you're upset about. Can we please just move on now from this?" But Micah isn't ready to move on yet, and neither should we be. You and I, as the people of God, need to take seriously the things that God takes seriously, and to the full extent that God takes them seriously. You know, you and I desire a God of justice, right? We want a God who opposes the sins of others. And yet, we don't really want him to be that opposed to our own sins, do we? It's real easy to sit here and see the things that other people are doing wrong, and we want God to judge them and, you know, fix that and correct and rebuke and all those things. But then when it comes to us, we want to just kind of move along. All right, let's move along here, God. I get it. Okay, you've said your thing. Now let's move on. And Micah causes us to one more time reflect on the condition of our own hearts and the things that maybe God might be wanting to say to us. Yes, we want to get past the part where the finger's pointing our way, but God doesn't want us to. He wants us to hear the fullness of what he has to say. And so the message here at the end of Micah is that God's vindicating justice is coming both, and hear this, the prepositions matter. His vindicating justice is not only coming to his people, but it's also coming for his people. He's not going to overlook their sins, okay? We've established that, and it's reiterated one more time here. And yet, God has this plan for his people beyond their judgment. And he's going to raise them up in a way, in such a way that only he can, where not only is sin dealt with, but his people aren't destroyed. And that's an amazing thing to me, that God in his wisdom can have both realities together perfectly. He's going to address the sin, but he's not going to destroy the people. He's going to raise them up, but not in such a way that undermines his justice whatsoever. So that's what we're looking at here as we finish up this chapter. Now, you know historically that the northern kingdom, which was called the kingdom of Israel at this time, fell to the Assyrians in 722 BC. And that's what Micah is writing right before this time, as the Assyrian horde is at the gates. They're getting ready to come in, and there's going to be great suffering, and the people will be exiled away. You know, all of their land will be plundered. They'll become foreigners in foreign lands. And that's in 722 BC. Now, the southern kingdom of Judah didn't fall until about 586 to Babylon. So that is a little farther down the road. But Micah's ultimately speaking to both kingdoms in those days. Now, while they are permitted to overcome God's people, the Assyrians, Micah is still warning his enemies here. You saw it just a moment ago in verse 8, not to rejoice and gloat, because God is going to raise him, and Micah is speaking on behalf of his people, God is going to raise him back up. So yes, God is executing judgment. God is disciplining his people through their enemies, And yet, to the enemies, God says, hey, don't get puffy here. Because after this season, I'm going to raise my people back up. After a downfall, there will be an uprising. After a time of darkness, there will be a time of light. Their enemies will have a day to mock God and his people. But a time is going to come, as we saw in verse 10, when God will vindicate his people. God's enemies will be trampled down. His enemies will be put to shame. Verses 11 and through 17 point to another glorious picture of restoration that we've already seen restoration promised throughout this letter. In fact, it's one of the key tenets of this whole message from Micah, is that yes, judgment is coming, but so is restoration. In fact, the restoration is going to come by means of the judgment. And here again in verses 11 through 17, we see another glorious picture of what that restoration is going to look like. Walls will be rebuilt. Boundary lines will be expanded. God's remnant that he preserves for himself will return. The nations will fear God. The nations will be in awe of God. It is true. God is judging the oppression and the injustices and the idolatry of his people. But as we've seen all along, and if you take nothing away from this entire book, please take this. God disciplines in order that he might redeem and rescue. That's central to understanding the heart of God. He's not just some angry deity off in the distance. He's close, he's personal, and yes, he has wrath, but his wrath and his love go together. And in his wrath, he judges and brings justice, but it's always with a redemptive end in mind. He hates the sin, he loves the sinner, to use a common expression that we are all familiar with. Judgment is coming, but so is blessing. And not just blessing to Israel, but blessing to all the world. You see, Micah has a bigger thing in mind than just the restoration of this small, relatively obscure and irrelevant people group in the middle of this region in the world. Micah has the salvation of the whole world in mind, even if maybe he doesn't fully comprehend that like you and I do on this side of history. God is not going to forsake the covenant he made with Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. When God promises that through Abraham and his offspring and his descendants, that all the nations will be blessed, God meant it. And Micah affirms that still. In the midst of all their sins, in the midst of all their idolatry, all the generations of people who went their own way and turned their back on God and failed to live up to their end of the covenant, God remains faithful. God remains committed. Because his promises don't rely on humanity's merit. His promises rely on his grace. And even as undeserving as his people are, and as the whole world might be, not a single person in the world is deserving of the grace of God, nevertheless, God will be faithful to his own promises because that's who he is in his heart. And friends, this should inspire hope and confidence, and it should help us in our own times of trouble because of the things we learn here about the nature of God and his character. You know, we've noted this a lot of times in the study. We've noted this a lot of times on Sundays from, you know, our pulpit and the worship services. The difficulties that you and I face in life are not evidences of God's abandonment or God's weakness. I know there's whole theological traditions in the world right now that would try to tell you that if you are experiencing any type of trial or tribulation or difficulty, it's because you don't have enough faith. And we wholeheartedly reject that because that is not the message of the scriptures. You and I both know that Jesus promised that trouble will come in this world because the world is broken. And you and I are invited to enter into Jesus' own suffering. In fact, to perfect and make complete his own sufferings in the world. Because it's only by suffering, his sufferings, that the world is redeemed. So if this world is going to be redeemed, it's going to be us participating in his own self-giving of his life for the sake of the world. So difficulties that you and I face are not evidence that God has abandoned us, nor are they evidence that God is somehow powerless against the darkness. And that could be the darkness out there in others, or it could be the darkness in our own hearts. God will permit trials. God will permit difficulties. God will even allow us to experience the consequences of our own moral failings in order to demonstrate his presence. You see, those things don't argue for his absence. Those are opportunities to experience his presence. And not just his presence. They're opportunities to experience his mightiness to save. Because you and I both know, like a good father, he lovingly disciplines those he loves. There we go. I want to make sure my notes are right on the screen. He lovingly disciplines those he loves. His discipline is not just some sort of angry punishment, some sort of impersonal thing to put you in your place. No, God's discipline is intended to restore. Deliverance and salvation will come to his people. And so Micah, in some ways, is almost like a philosopher here, all the way in the Old Testament. Before Jesus ever stepped onto the scene, Micah is causing us to consider how to hold together the justice and wrath of God with his deliverance and his grace. It's a question that the Old Testament is occupied with all throughout the pages. How can he do both these at the same time? How can God be genuinely and perfectly wrathful towards evil in the world, but also infinitely loving and patient with people? How do the two work together? How do you hold this tension together? Now, it's easy and natural for God, because God is if God is the infinite and perfect one, then he's infinite and perfect in all of his attributes. So if wrath is part of God's nature, then he is infinitely and perfectly wrathful. But if he's loving, then he's infinitely and perfectly loving. And he can be both at the same time, because it's his nature to do so. And it's easy and natural for him to do that. But it's hard for us to wrap our minds around it, right? Because you and I have a hard time holding anything in tension together, or holding anything in balance. I feel like my whole life is in balance. From the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed, I'm either doing too much of this and not enough of that, or I act this way too much and not enough like that. And you see the ripple effect of our mess. My sister likes the expression, she'll say, I'm a hot mess. And I feel like I'm a hot mess all the time. And I see the impact of that on how I use my time, on how I treat my kids or my wife. I mean, it's almost impossible for us to balance and manage our own lives moment by moment. But God, it's simple and effortless for him to be who he is all the time. And so as we're trying to establish this balance and this tension between justice and wrath and deliverance and grace, what's easy for God is hard for us. We love the ideas of heaven. We love the ideas of forgiveness and bliss. And yet we bristle at the ideas of hell and wrath and judgment. And we have a hard time reconciling the two. How can God be all loving and yet still send someone to hell? That's the popular expression, right? How can God be all loving but send people to hell? I would invite you to think about it this way. In a broken world, such as the one we live in, think of it like this. How can there ever be real peace without wrath and judgment? I mean, how can God claim to be holy and compassionate unless there is justice and vindication for the oppressed? And how can there be justice and vindication for the oppressed unless there is judgment for evil and injustice? I mean, if there is no ultimate accounting for evil, then what do you say to the Jews about Hitler? I mean, if there's not some sort of ultimate reckoning for the great evil that he perpetrated upon an entire race of people, you know, 6 million Jews died at his hand. What do you say to those people if there's no ultimate accounting for the evil that Hitler was responsible for? What do you say to the little girl sold into human trafficking, the victim of serial sexual abuse? What do you say to her if there's no wrath against evil, if there is no justice and vindication for the oppressed, or to the little boy beaten and abused by his father? It might be fashionable in our day to say, I don't want a wrathful God, but I do want a loving, merciful, and gracious God. But if God is truly loving, then isn't he also outraged by evil? Is that not an essential component to his love? You see, his love and his wrath are not in opposition to one another. His love and his wrath are two sides of the same coin. It's because he loves us that he hates the sin that brings destruction to our lives. And doesn't said outrage speak to his high estimation of the worth of people? I mean, if God looked at the oppressed in the world and was not roused to indignation and moved to bring justice to the oppressed, then you couldn't say that he loved them very much, could you? But we see his response to the evil and the oppression and the injustice of the world in his wrath points to his very high estimation of the value and worth of people. A God who does not vindicate, a God who does not execute wrath on evil, is not a God that we can say is loving at all. Now, I try to teach these lessons to my children. My daughter's 13. My middle son is 11. My youngest is 7. So they're at least a couple of them are getting into the age range where they can become a little more, they can think a little more abstractly, a little more philosophically than when they were small children. But from the smallest age, I've always tried to teach a lot of these basic truths to them, to help them to see that I discipline you, and this might be the hardest thing in the world for a little kid to understand, but I think intuitively they know in their heart. They may not understand it rationally, but somewhere in the heart, I think they get it. When I say, I discipline you because I love you, and I mean it. I know that I'm not a perfect person. I know that my discipline is not always completely righteous. I get it. I'm a broken, fallible human being, just like my child is. I'm prone to being emotional. I have an incomplete knowledge of everything. I don't always see, you know, those of you parents out there, how many quarrels did you have to sift through between your children when they're telling different stories from the same event and you weren't there to see it? So you're trying to bring, you know, resolution to a situation that you didn't even see firsthand. And you're basing your decisions and your judgments on two very different perspectives of the same event. We have imperfect knowledge of things. I even times as an imperfect father have wrong motives. There's times where I have a tendency to discipline out of my own frustration rather than out of love. I will confess that to them, and I'll apologize to them when I do. In fact, I have just this week had to apologize to a child for reacting the wrong way and coming down hard for the wrong reasons. I'm not above sinning in my discipline. I all that aside, deep in my heart, though, I aim to discipline my children out of their own best interest because of my love for them. Now, you can see plenty of examples in the world where people discipline their kids for all the wrong reasons. But for a Christian parent, if I don't show them the boundary lines for life, then I'm allowing them to follow roads that result in their own destruction. That doesn't sound very loving, does it? You know, so the completely hands-off approach to parenting that doesn't offer any correction or any rebuke or any discipline of any kind out of love is not loving at all. Because your children are little sinners. They have sinful nature. Their heart, the disposition of their heart from conception is one of shaking the fist in the face of their creator. It's not just observed behavior. It's innate. And because it is innate, and because they have a corrupted, fallen, immoral heart, they need to be, you don't need to teach a child how to sin. They know how to do that. You need to teach a child how to obey. You need to teach a child how to tell the truth. You need to teach a child how to honor and respect your parents. You need to teach a child how to follow instruction. And if you don't give them boundary lines and sometimes establish them firmly, and you think you're doing that out of love, well, you're not loving your children at all because you're allowing them to go their own way. And anytime people go their own way, they always choose destruction for themselves and everyone around them. It's amazing the collateral damage that a sinful heart can cause in this world. Every one of you out there has someone in your life who has what seems like unrestrained sin in their heart, and they bring destruction and misery and suffering to every person they come into contact with. And you have whole families, your family, tonight, might be in complete disarray and in incredible heartache and pain and suffering because somebody has not surrendered their heart to Jesus, and their heart is rebellious and sinful and polluted, and it's a toxic touch on every relationship in their life. So when I'm dealing with my kids, I'm trying to discipline them righteously. I want them to understand, if you can't obey me in the small things, how can you ever hope to obey God in the big things? And I know that breaking one of my rules might result in, you know, getting time out or something taken away, or God forbid, a slap on the backside. But breaking God's rules have eternal consequences. So when I talk to my kids about these things, the goal is not to scare them into obedience. I want them to fear and respect authority. And those are different things. Being scared of God and fearing God are not the same thing. But the message of discipline and the message of I do these things because I love you and for the boundary lines and because I want you to understand what it means to follow God's rules All of that is accompanied by words and gestures of mercy and restoration. Everything you see in Micah. You see the firmest of God's boundary lines being established. You see the harshest, strongest language of rebuke and discipline and judgment. But every time, it is accompanied with promises of restoration and rescue. Every single time. You see, for us, where we struggle to keep these things held together, for God, it's effortless. Because they're essential to his nature. He hates sin. He loves people. He hates sin. He loves people. And those are not mutually exclusive. They go together every time. So when I discipline my children, I try always to accompany the discipline with restoration. You are wrong. I'm holding you accountable. These are the consequences. But here's why. It's all because I love you. I had a conversation with one of my kids tonight. I'm not going to tell you which one it was because it's not fair to them. And I won't tell you the gender because it could possibly give it away because I only have one girl. So if I say it's a boy, then you whittled it down to two. But if I say it's a girl, you'll know who I'm talking about. So I'm not even going to go down that road. But we had a disagreement at dinner time. You know, we try every meal. There's a main course. There's a side and there's a vegetable. I don't care what you do with the first two. You're eating the vegetable. You will have vegetable, a vegetable, a fruit at lunch, a vegetable at dinner every day. and the vegetable tonight was salad. And I've got a child that hates salad. And the heels dug in. And there was entrenchment. I'm not eating this. And then when we made it clear that they were, then it was, well, I'm not putting salad dressing on it. I'm just going to eat the plain. And for me, I didn't care about salad dressing or not. For me, it was the attitude of the heart. And I was like, everything that the child said they were not going to do, I require them to do. Because I was going to teach them that I don't care about, I mean, yes, I care about your physical health, but I care about your spiritual health. I care about your heart. And so we had this kind of knockdown, drag out thing at dinner and they ate their salad. They were mad about it. But after dinner, I went to their room and I got down on my knees and I told them I love them. I said, yes, I care about your body's health, but I care more about your heart. I care more about your heart. And for me, the issue tonight wasn't about nutrition. The issue was about rebellion, stubbornness, disobedience. And those are things I will always correct because left uncorrected, those will result in the destruction of your soul. I love you too much to let that happen. And I don't know if they liked hearing that or not, but discipline, rescue, restoration. Hard word, soft word. Micah, the scriptures. God's wrath, God's grace, always together. We can know the motive behind everything God does because he'll make it clear to us. And discipline is costly. You know, for a parent, it costs time. I can't tell you how many times I've had to come home from, I work 50 feet from where I live. And I can't tell you how many times in a week I have to come home and help with discipline. It takes time. It's frustrating when I'm super swamped and have things going on and fires everywhere and I need to come give my wife support. It's costly. It takes energy. I think being a good parent is the hardest job in the world because it's effort. It's consistency. It's intentionality. And this is the one my kids really don't understand is when, and maybe all of us have never believed it when we were young, but when a parent says, this hurts me more than it hurts you, that's actually true. I hate being, well, I don't hate, that's probably too strong a word. I've experienced great discomfort when my child is hurting. I don't take pleasure in the discipline of my child. In the sense of, it's not like I'm some sort of, what's the word, a masochist? Or someone who like delights in the misery or the suffering of another person. That's not my heart at all. It hurts. It hurts to see your child upset and crying, especially when they're mad at you. Doesn't feel good when they say they hate you. You ever had that? Your child tell you they hate you? John's nodding over here. Don't do that, John, because you're going to give your kids away. I've heard that twice. I've heard it twice in 13 years of being a parent. I've heard it twice. And I didn't give it away on my face. But man, it stung my heart. it hurts. But listen, any father who is not willing to make whatever sacrifice is necessary for his kids, no matter the cost to himself or the pain it will bring to anyone else involved, for the sake of his child's life and heart and health, is not a loving father. And what's true of us, humanly speaking, is true of God. God will do whatever is necessary for our benefit. However much pain, however much suffering, not just for us, but for himself. We'll come back to that in just a minute. You may have heard of C.S. Lewis's volume, Letters to Malcolm. And in this, what has become a book, he's responding to Malcolm's trouble with the idea of a wrathful God. So Malcolm thinks it's more helpful to think of God's power and wrath and justice if you imagine it like a live electrical wire, this impersonal thing that's just kind of lying there on the floor. You know, there's power there. If you touch it, you'll get hurt. It's not a personal conscious power. It doesn't get angry with us. But if we blunder against it, we get a shock. And here's what Lewis had to say in response to that. I love C.S. Lewis, and everything he says is just on point. And he says this: "My dear Malcolm, what do you suppose you have gained by substituting the image of a live wire for that of an angered majesty? You have shut us all up in despair, for the angry can forgive, and electricity can't. Turn God's wrath into mere enlightened disapproval, and you also turn his love into mere humanitarianism. The consuming fire and the perfect beauty both vanish. We have instead a judicious headmistress or a conscientious magistrate." I love how the British speak, and I love how the British intellectuals speak, and C.S. Lewis never fails to impress. Look, if our conception of God is that he's simply a God of love, and that's the sum total of what we can say about God, and he's not a God of personal love and personal justice, then we'll never know if you and I are truly valued, will we? Nor we can ever be certain that there will ever even be any justice, ever. For love to truly be love, there must also be judgment. Without it, there is no hope for the slave. There's no hope for the rape victim. There's no hope for the abused or the bullied or the suffering. We need, and I would say even should want, a God who gets righteously angry over evil. One who will not tolerate it, even for a second, but who instead is personally committed to and invested in eradicating it forever. So it should not come as a surprise to us then when we see that a loving God would judge, because he's a holy God. He's going to judge. What should come as a surprise to us is that a holy God would find a way to forgive. That should be the thing that occupies our mind. Like, how can that be? Remember Micah's name, right? What does it mean? It means who is like God? And the answer, of course, is no one. I don't know anyone like God. Not at the heart of who they are. We're all because of the brokenness of humanity, by default, we are very much unlike God. Now, he wants to make us like himself. That's the whole point of his salvation. But no one is like God but God. He is both just and merciful. He is perfect and holy and has hostility towards evil. And yet he pardons and shows patience and grace towards the ones perpetrating evil. And in his infinite wisdom, he both deals with sin, but also embraces the sinner. And how does Micah, in his little volume here, how does he resolve this great tension? The thing that you and I struggle to do, but God has no trouble doing. Well, look at verse 9 again. This is the key to it all. He says, this is Micah speaking about himself now. He says, "I will endure the rage of the Lord because I have sinned against him until he pleads my case and he executes justice for me." Isn't that amazing? If imagine heaven as a courtroom and you're standing there before the judge, Micah's saying, the very same judge who finds us guilty is also the one who pleads our case for us. The very same one who executes justice on my behalf. I'm the one who's been unjust. And yet he's going to execute justice not only towards me, but on behalf of me. Who is Micah pointing to here? Well, of course, Jesus. Micah is leading us to the cross, the place where God himself executed justice against my sin, but upon himself. Because God went on trial. God bore our judgment, and therefore his own justice is satisfied. The court is adjourned. You and I walk free, and we haven't done a thing to deserve it. Romans 3:26, so that he would be just, So God's justice is never a one for a second compromised. Ever. In all of this talk about salvation and grace and forgiveness, never for a second is God's mercy unsatisfied. I'm sorry, God's wrath unsatisfied. The fullness of his wrath on sin has been poured out on his son. So he can be just. He is just. But he's also the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Wrath, grace. Justice, mercy. In perfect balance on the cross. The fullness of his wrath, the fullness of his love. Never in opposition, never in conflict, but in perfect harmony. Always. Micah couldn't possibly have known how God would resolve this tension. We have no indication that Micah had some sort of vision into the future, a physical vision where he saw Jesus hanging on a cross. I can imagine that ever crossed his mind. He didn't know how God would resolve the tension, but he believed that God would. And that's because he knew God's heart. And that's a great lesson for us tonight. As we look at the situations we find ourselves in life, and we say, you know what? I don't know how God is going to enter into this. I don't know how God is going to bring resolution to this. I don't know how God could possibly redeem all this darkness that I'm immersed in, but I know that he will because I know his heart. He's proven himself time and time and time. His faithfulness to 1,000 generations is enough for me to stake this moment of my life upon. I don't know how. I just know that he will. Micah knows God's heart. Look again in verses 18 through 20. Who is a God like you who pardons wrongdoing? He knows what God is like. He pardons wrongdoing and passes over a rebellious act of the remnant of his possession. He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in mercy. He's wrathful, but he's merciful. He will again take pity on us. He will trample on our wrongdoings. Yes, you will cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob, favor to Abraham, which you swore to our forefathers from the days of old. In other words, Micah is saying, God, I know you're going to judge our sin because you are God of justice, but I also know that you have promised to forgive, to remove our sins, and to delight in making us your own once again. And I don't know how, but I believe you will. God the Son is the one who fulfills verse 9. Jesus came into the world in order to plead our case and bear God's indignation that we deserved. He went through hell on the cross. He experienced the fullness of God's righteous abandonment. He went into the darkness of exile in Sheol, experiencing the full extent and the consequences of what sin has produced in the world and in our own lives. And yet, the one who has every right in the world to speak against us is the very one who speaks for us. Hebrews 7:25. He is able to save forever those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Isn't that amazing? That Jesus conquered death, he rose from the grave, he ascended into heaven. Why? So he could stand at the right hand of the Father and intercede for you perpetually forever. He lives, he ever lives above for me to intercede. You remember that great Wesley hymn, Arise, My Soul, Arise. That verse that says, five bleeding wounds he bears, two in the hands, two in the wrist, and one in his side. Five bleeding wounds he bears, received on Calvary. They pour effectual prayers. They strongly plead for me. Forgive him, Lord, forgive, they cry. Forgive him, Lord, forgive, they cry. Nor let that ransomed sinner die. Jesus is our great high priest who intercedes for us moment by moment from the right hand of God the Father. The one who had every right to argue against us and speak against us is the very one who speaks for us. And so, because of these things, how do we respond? Well, we are a people who should at once be broken under indignation and yet bold in God's grace. You and I need to be that moment by moment, both. Yes, broken by our failures and yet bold in the grace of God. Contrite in our failings. If your moral failings or your falling short of the glory of God, if you're missing the mark, if your sin does not break you at the level of the heart, then you've missed everything God has ever said about sin. But if your sin crushes you to the point of hopeless despair, then you miss everything God has ever said about his grace. We are to be bold I'm sorry. We are to be broken and yet bold. We are to be contrite in our failings and yet confident in his mercy. And all this is because of Christ alone, who shows us not only the cost and the consequences of the things we've done wrong, but also the immeasurable riches of God's kindness and his mercy. He shows us both. And our boldness and confidence can only ever be found in him. So how do we respond day by day? I'm going to be talking about this again this Sunday from the pulpit. There has to be in us a genuine admission of sin. We have to be real about it. This is not something we just, you know, gloss over or dismiss or pretend it's not a big deal. It's always a big deal to God. God is always hostile towards evil. He will not tolerate it, ever. So there must be a genuine admission of sin. And yet, at the same time, for the truly faithful, there has to be a complete trust in his forgiveness. We see it right here in Micah. We think all this talk about grace and mercy and stuff is only for the New Testament. No, no, no. In the Bible, righteousness always comes by faith from the beginning of Genesis to the end of Revelation. It's not law and then grace. It is the righteous will live by faith. It is by faith that a righteous man has life. And in all of the atoning work of God through the sacrificial system was all grace. They weren't earning it. It's just their guilt was transferred to another. And God in his grace would bring forgiveness to those who in faith approached him in such a way. And Micah was sincere and honest when he confessed, I have sinned against the Lord. And yet he exercised the faith by which one is justified by grace, by trusting in the very one he sinned against, that God would plead my case. I've sinned against him, and yet he's the one that's going to plead on behalf of me. It's the gospel in Micah, the whole gospel right there in just a verse. I have sinned against him. He will plead my case and execute justice for me. It sounds a lot like 1 John 1:9 to me. That promise that Jesus secured at the cost of his own life, that if we confess our sins, he is faithful and righteous so that he will forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So you, right there, you have a genuine admission of sin. If you take your genuine admission of sin to God, then you can have complete trust in his forgiveness. It is a promise. This is the life of the righteous and the faithful. All right, 7:47. That's our cue to wrap this thing up. I've had a great time teaching, and I get energized and excited to be in here on Wednesday nights. I'm so glad John was in here because I got to spend my last evening this summer with another person instead of being alone. But I hope this study has been helpful to you. I hope at the very least it's brought, like I said at the beginning, what seems like maybe an obscure book of the Bible. I hope it's brought some new light to you on what's going on there and what this prophet is talking about. I hope it has given you a framework even to evaluate the condition and the content of your own heart. I've tried every week to challenge you and myself with the lessons from here. It's not just about Micah's message to the people then. It's God's message through his prophet for us today. I hope you've come to understand more deeply the character of God. I hope it's caused you to love God more deeply and to trust more completely in his mercy and his grace. I think he wants us to be a people. I think the expectations on his people then are the same today. He wants us to be a people who love justice and do works of justice and are compassionate and merciful. He wants us to be a people who not only proclaim his holy love to the world, but embody it and live it out. A people of truth and love and justice and compassion, extensions of his own life given away for the salvation of the world that he created and loves. So I hope that was the case for you. I know it was for me. And I just want to thank you for taking the time to be here on Wednesday nights and to go through this study with me. God bless you as you seek to live faithfully for Jesus in this world that so desperately needs you to. So with that, we're going to go to our time of transition. Don't log out. Instead, go to the comment section. Think of any prayer requests that you have, or maybe any praises you have. We can give God praise for the ways he's answered prayer. And put those in the comment section right away, so that when we come back here in a minute or two, we can spend our last 8 or 9 minutes together in prayer. So we'll be right back.